is the Republican Party right now is not led by conservatives. There's a population out there that has to be told the truth. We have to do it live.
Now, from the left coast, it's another podcast edition of the Peter B. Collins Show. Peter B. is curious, opinionated, and relentless in pursuit of the truth like a honeybee drawn to pollen. He's an independent progressive, ready to sting Republicans and Democrats alike when they deserve it. After years in commercial radio, Peter B. welcomes you to this audio adventure in news and politics with no corporate filter. Listeners support this program, and you can help at peterbcollins.com. Here's your humble host, Peter B.
And as the pronouncer told you, listeners support the Peter B. Collins Show. I'm very grateful. And we like to name names. Rick and Catherine Arndt of Boise, Idaho, discovered the Peter B. Collins podcast. And they send me a little check every month, and I'm very grateful. Thank you. If you can help and you'd like to help, just go to my website, peterbcollins.com. We don't hide the information. It's right there on the homepage. And you can subscribe voluntarily for as little as $5 a month. And we're not a bank, so we didn't get a bailout. And so whatever trickles down to you that can trickle down to me, well, mo better. Have you seen Michael Moore's Capitalism, A Love Story? It's not perfect, but it's a perfect reminder of the debacle that began in September of 2008. In the last months of the Bush administration, we were pillaged. And what really hurts is that after we were given another one of those pre-election, feared-up, false choices, and Nancy Pelosi did the bidding of the Bush White House when Republicans wouldn't support the bailout plans, now they're rubbing it in. Because the firms that survived are largely back on their feet, and they're going to pay record bonuses this year. It's really disgusting. Nomi Prinz joins me today here on the Peter B. Collins Show. She's been with us before. Her new book is out, and I am looking forward to reading it. It's called It Takes a Pillage. And Nomi is an economist who worked on Wall Street, a managing director at Goldman Sachs, worked internationally for Bear Stearns, a senior managing director in London. And she speaks the truth, and she knows what she's talking about. Nomi, welcome back to our program.
Oh, thank you so much, Peter.
And have you seen Michael Moore's film? Do you have a reaction to it?
I am very embarrassed to say I have not seen it, mostly because I've been running around touring with my book, and I want to get to a movie theater. It is on my list, but unfortunately it has not happened yet.
Yeah. Well, as I said in the intro, he does a good job of reminding us of things that happened just a year ago. And it's not perfect. For example, you know, I feel he focuses on the Republican Windows and Doors Company in Chicago and the sit-in by employees who were fired without notice and got no severance pay. And he oversimplifies the story by just making the bad guy out to be Bank of America. And Bank of America was a player there. But there was bad management at Republic, too. And that's one of the things about Michael Moore, where often, in his desire to make a strong impact, he will kind of glide over some of the details of a story that might get in the way of making a strong impression. But overall, it's a stark reminder of how much money we have shoveled into the finance system in this country, or that's based in this country. And the manner in which it was done was so cavalier. And every time I see Elizabeth Warren on television, who is the Harvard Law professor who was put in charge of overseeing the $700 billion TARP fund, I mean, it seems like payday loan operators keep better records than the Fed did when they were shoveling out trillions of dollars.
Yeah, it's one of the reasons I actually wrote the book was because, in addition to just the general crisis aspects behind it, was the bailout itself has just been this incredibly murky, very non-recorded, non-transparent, and sort of non-discussed. I mean, we know it's tremendously large, but from the standpoint of a lot of the different aspects in Washington, we've never had Tim Geithner, for example, since he became Treasury Secretary, or Henry Paulson as he was leaving from being Treasury Secretary, really discuss the volume of bailout and subsidization of the industry that occurred. It's almost like the $700 billion of the TARP money that was approved last October 3rd is it, and it's so far from it. In fact, the number's actually down a little bit from its height in terms of subsidies to the industry, but basically TARP at one point was just 4% of the multi-trillions of dollars that were made available to all sorts of banks, particularly the stronger, more powerful, larger ones in the industry.
And the outstanding amount of cash, credit, and guarantees that have come from the Fed and Treasury to these industries, it's north of $13 trillion, is it not?
Right, which is about what it is now. I mean, at one point, it was as high as $17.5 trillion. And the reason you just give or take a trillion here or there was because at one point there was about $3.7 trillion that was made available to back all of the money market funds in the country. And that was actually just closed in September. So that kind of brings us down to a sort of $13 trillion subsidization of the industry, a lot of which came through the Federal Reserve. They created eight different loan facilities, basically little credit unions that only banks can use, where the banks got to dump a lot of the collateral, a lot of assets they didn't want on their books. And in return for dumping stuff that wasn't particularly valuable and for which we still have no details to this day, they received very, very cheap different types of short and longer term loans from the Fed at interest rates between 0.25%. So basically for nothing.
Well, and I'm third in line at discount window number two, but it hasn't reopened.
Well, I mean, that's the whole thing. This whole bailout, everything behind it was never really, the myths behind it were about loosening credit and it would help the little person and small businesses. And if there wasn't this whole funneling of money into the system as it was on the verge of collapse last fall, that somehow the world would cease to exist and global markets would you know, just completely deteriorate forever. And obviously that wasn't really going to happen, but somehow that was what was bought in Congress, and that was pushed by the Treasury Secretary and Ben Bernanke, head of the Federal Reserve, as well as Tim Geithner, who actually met more with Hank Paulson than did Ben Bernanke. So there was a lot of sort of positioning going on at the time.
Well, and I want to get into those contacts that were occurring during the alleged crisis last fall, because you've posted an article that's fascinating in that respect. But first, when we look at the amount of money that was put in play and the minimal disclosures that they've given us, I'm thinking of the President of the United States. I'm thinking of Chairman Bernanke. He went to Kansas City in July, I think it was, for a town hall meeting that the PBS NewsHour spieled out over three or four nights, and he was sticking to the talking points that the entirety of the Fed's action was related to the $700 billion TARP fund. And I think that he may not have lied, but he didn't tell the full truth, so help me God.
No, and I really wish he had been pressed a lot more on those town halls. I had sent some of my bailout figures into NewsHour beforehand, but you know, a lot of what's ironic about that, and also how the president and Treasury Secretary now have been sort of dealing with what the bailout represents, is that it's not like the information is unavailable. It's just hard to get together. You know, I'm not the only one who sort of dug into what the Fed has done, but what I did was itemize it, and it's not completely secret. What is secret is what's the collateral and how much loans went out to which bank. So what is secret to this day is who got what for what.
Mm-hmm.
But what isn't secret is the sheer size of those loan facilities and the size of the guarantees and the size of all the capital help that went in. And that's what amounts to over $13 trillion. And that was for AIG. That was for the Bear Stearns acquisition by J.P. Morgan when Bear Stearns was falling apart in March before the rest of the crisis. It's for asset guarantees to Citigroup, which to this day holds them and to this day can't actually turn a profit without the government subsidies that it's received. Same thing for components of Bank of America.
Mm-hmm.
It includes some of the money that's going to be going out for Tim Geithner's public-private investment fund, whereby hedge funds get to buy toxic assets and the government gets to basically go in with $6 for every dollar that they put in to back that.
Right. It's more where the losses are socialized and the profits are corporatized.
Exactly. It goes on and on. And so, you know, when you get to a situation where now we're seeing record bonuses come back by some of the firms that were most at risk and maneuvered most well, of course, during the crisis period last fall. You know, it's not just jealousy and disgust. It's more than that. It's this idea of like, wait a minute, they're not even doing this anymore on their own. Yes, we socialize their risks and their losses, and now we're socializing their capital. But we don't do that for the rest of the economy to anywhere near the same extent.
Well, is there any way, you know, Citigroup is on track here, according to the Wall Street Journal, to pay out bonus compensation of, let's see, about $133,000. Oh, I'm sorry, I was on the wrong line. $71,000 per employee. Now, we own that bank. We don't claim it. But, you know, the amount of money that we put in exceeded the market capitalization of Citicorp, when the Fed intervened. And while, you know, Obama declined to use the term nationalizing that financial institution, we should have claimed it. And then we'd get a return on that investment. But it really seems just fundamentally a way of screwing the American people further to pay out these bonuses this year. And I understand that, you know, some of the compensation is based on performance. But when the overall performance of these institutions is in the red, how can they be paying out these mega, mega bonuses?
Well, you know, and that goes to the core of how bonuses get really discussed offline and off media within each of these firms. Because what happens is there are numerous employees who don't get the big bucks at these firms. And if they get a bonus, you know, we're talking about potentially, an administrative assistant who might get a 10 or 20% bonus on top of whatever her salary might be. And that doesn't really bother us in any way. The thing is, they don't break down these bonuses. And the reason they don't break down these bonuses publicly, which I think would be useful, especially given that we have given so much public money to these funds to sort of know where some of that money has gone, is they put in these lump sums. So it makes it seem like if there's an average of $133,000 per person, or the average I think is more like $750,000 per person at Goldman that everyone is getting at. And something worse is happening. There are many people who get nowhere near that, and then there are a few people who get much, much more than that. And so what happens within the firms is there's this constant jockeying to be in that top group, that tiny group that gets the much more. That's kind of what we see. So I think that a lot of this stuff is also a maneuver by these banks not to have to disclose the exact nature of how all this stuff gets paid out, because that would make them look even worse than they already look by paying out record bonuses, some of them, after a year in which they almost collapsed. And there is really no excuse for that.
Now back to Citigroup for a minute here. According to the Wall Street Journal, the total bonus pool for this year at Citigroup is $22 billion.
Right, and I have that number actually $25 billion, but it's we're projecting.
Okay.
But yes.
And how much capital did taxpayers put into Citigroup?
No, that's a very good point. We put in different ways. There's the $45 billion that came from two parts of the TARP money, but there's also another $301 billion in guarantees against a lot of the assets that are sitting on Citigroup. So basically, between the Treasury and the Fed, and to a smaller extent the FDIC, there was this agreement to effectively loan Citigroup money using these assets as collateral. And if these assets fall apart, or devalue, that the government would step in and sort of kind of make that be a wash. And so that was another part of the money that, that Citigroup received. Altogether, Citigroup right now is sitting on $398 billion worth of federal subsidies. So, yes, paying $25 billion in bonuses doesn't make any sort of sense on the back of that. You know, you would think that you just cut down to compensation, you know, to bare salaries, and not to bonuses, but that's not really what they're doing.
Nomi Prinz with us here on the Peter B. Collins Show. And Nomi, as we look at this, certainly there is runaway greed and absolutely no shame on the part of these executives who are going to take this bonus money. But we also have to look at our side, meaning the government, because we didn't have arm's length negotiations with these parties who were accepting the bailout funds. And we didn't properly negotiate, and this is where we go to Elizabeth Warren again, we didn't properly negotiate terms. I mean,
they were very, very light terms. Exactly.
I mean, if you have a yogurt store and you need some working capital and I loan you the money, I would probably stipulate in that agreement that you got to pay me back before you can pay yourself a bonus.
Think. And again, that's only if we thought the $700 billion of TARP was it. Then you get the Fed in there that's given all sorts of money, and you get the FDIC backing all sorts of debt, and it just becomes more and more of a bizarre entitlement issue. And, you know, so you remember last year when all this was going down, we're also in the middle of an election. Everybody's concerned about either their seats or the seats of the person next to them. Who's getting this? Who's, you know, how is the House going to look? How's the Senate going to look? Who's going to be in the presidency? And there was so much at stake all over the place that somehow in this panic, one of the other things that happened was the decision to listen to Hank Paulson among, well, as the loudest voice, who basically said, you know, we need to do this. We need to find a way to open the doors. And that's what he was saying to Congress. In conversations with Tim Geithner and Ben Bernanke, a lot more was going on because a lot more money wound up flying out the door. And no one seemed to be asking questions because somehow there was this perhaps, maybe idea that if this money didn't go into the banking system, everything would fall apart and it would just, like, look bad, particularly at that time. So we had this, like, perfect storm of just, you know, an election, a crisis, and a bailout, and none of it wound up working towards helping most of the consumers that would have been hurt by the foreclosures and the credit problems that continue to plague the general population to this day, and are actually worse now than they were going into the crisis.
And Nomi, was this a Chicken Little moment? Was the sky falling, or did they just tell us that?
What happened was there were some companies that ran out of capital, and Bear Stearns started in the beginning of the year, and then Lehman Brothers. It basically ran out of capital. It couldn't pay. It couldn't keep the money going to basically keep the bets going related to these, you know, what we refer to as toxic assets. And basically,
right,
there had been so much money borrowed against them that once the assets themselves had no value, the companies weren't good for that money, and so they decided to, well, Lehman Brothers wanted to get government support and didn't get it and fell apart.
Right.
And then Goldman Sachs used that and Morgan Stanley used that to basically scare or maneuver themselves into getting funding and being called banks and, or bank holding companies and everything else. I don't think the sky was going to fall. There were going to be other bankruptcies, absolutely.
Mm-hmm.
But that in itself doesn't mean that the sky is falling. A scenario that could have happened instead was that, say, Lehman Brothers went under. Merrill Lynch could have gone under instead of being given to Bank of America, but I think right now that whole thing is such a big mess that's going to be something we're going to continue to look at. One of or both of Goldman Sachs and Morgan Stanley were also looking at no capital, and one or both of them could have gone bankrupt. Maybe Citigroup would have not gone. Maybe it would have gone bankrupt. Then it would have gone into receivership. Then it would have had to sell off some of its divisions, but still keep the ones that deal with consumers, and so therefore a lot of actual public services would not have been disrupted.
And Nomi, I have to say that, you know, I'm a liberal and I accept capitalism, but this episode brought out the fundamental capitalist in me, and that is I believe in limited liability. The corporate form, I think, is a brilliant structure for spreading risk and advancing ingenuity, entrepreneurship, and productivity. And at the same time, I believe in bankruptcy. And
right.
the analogy I would offer is I'm a low ball craps player. I like to go to the casino. I'll take $100, and when I lose it, I leave the table. And I accept that I lost, and I go have a drink and I forget about it.
that's exactly what could have gone down with a few of these firms who instead received a lot of public subsidy is, you know, if they screwed up, if they bet too much, if it was against them, you know, stuff happens like that. And regular people, when they bet too hard or too much, don't have the same sort of cushion by any stretch of the imagination as a select few banks received. And those select few banks, anyway, got more out of the government than a lot of the community and smaller banks throughout the country as well. So it really came down to not only covering their losses, but covering the losses of a very select group of powerful banks.
And the other thing that, and these are not identical or even perhaps comparable, but the way we were told over and over again, we simply cannot let GM or Chrysler go into bankruptcy. We can't. And what we saw was they did go through bankruptcy even after we loaned them almost $20 billion. And I expect we'll never see that money. And that money was used to shut down plants and lay off workers. It didn't.
Doesn't, because it doesn't come with strings. I mean, it goes back to what you were saying before. When you hammer out this stuff really quickly, you should have some sort of a knee-jerk reaction, even in the midst of this chaos, to sort of ask for something in return. Or at least, you know, use that moment to get something in return, and that just kind of completely passed. And for the auto industry as well as obviously the banking industry in a much larger manner.
Well, when it comes to Detroit, I was screaming and nobody was listening, but I had a plan similar to the Cash for Clunkers deal, which was that we should have just ordered 500,000 cars from Detroit that were green cars, either hybrids, high-mileage gas vehicles, or electric cars, because we know GM knows how to make those. They just didn't want to make them.
I would rather have
fronted money or, you know, found way to subsidize consumer purchases to stimulate manufacturing rather than to loan them money to contract.
And you would have been sensible, and the same thing could have happened. That notion of doing that with the auto industry and basically subsidizing the things, the products, and the sort of the consumer relationship at the bottom of these companies,
yes.
You know, not sort of at the top level and be
yes.
like, okay, here's some bailout money, just figure out what to do with it, because that worked out so well for you going into this period. And the same thing could have happened with the banking system. Rather than giving hundreds of billions of dollars to back Citigroup's assets at the top level, what could have happened is giving hundreds of billions of dollars or even less to renegotiate mortgages of individuals, which would have had the benefit of helping individuals make their payments. It would have had the benefit of stopping losses going into the bottom line of Citigroup, you know, and of other banks. And it would have had the benefit of actually stabilizing more of the general economy. And all of those sort of bottom-up approaches just didn't make it into play.
Noemi Prinz with us here on the Peter B. Collins Show. Her new book is available. It's called It Takes a Pillage, and it's something that you definitely ought to pick up. When I've had a chance to read it, I'll invite Noemi back here to talk about it. But I want to ramp up a little Blondie here, because Noemi Prinz has a future at the NSA. She has been digging through telephone records and data mined some fascinating information. An October 12th post at the Daily Beast is a must-read. And somebody there at Daily Beast did a great job of getting a picture of Hank Paulson looking really scared and talking into his cell phone. And we know that Hank was on the phone a lot, starting in September at least, if not before that. And Noemi, before we talk about who he was talking with and who talked to whom and who wasn't talking very much, One of the critical issues here that I think should be investigated for potential criminal or ethical violations is that Hank Paulson left Goldman Sachs to become George W. Bush's Treasury Secretary, and he signed a pledge not to have contact with the very people that he used to work with. And we know that he blew past that, and at some point in September, somebody wrote him a memo that said, you can forget about your pledge not to talk to the people you used to work with. But fundamentally, wasn't this, unethical or at least unseemly?
I think unseemly and definitely questionable on the ethics, considering the man had just come from being the CEO of Goldman Sachs into the Treasury Secretary Department. The argument that is made in Washington, and Tim Geithner uses this as well, even though he didn't actually come from being a CEO of Goldman, is that you can't not talk to the heads of the most powerful financial, I don't know if they use the word powerful, but from the largest financial institutions in the country, because, as you know, it's almost your responsibility to know what they're doing and what's going on. So there's this like finesse of the black and white lines between what's right and what's wrong with that sort of argument that, well, of course they need to be talking to these people because they need to know what's going on so they can protect the American public or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
And that's how this sort of all gets bypassed.
So you got a Freedom of Information Act release on Tim Geithner's phone records, his phone logs, and it must have taken you quite a while, 415 pages, to go through all this stuff. And tell us what sifted out when you analyzed all of this telephone activity.
Well, actually, what's ironic is I didn't personally get the FOIA request. There was a number of institutions and publications trying to get these records for a while, of which one that I worked with was the Nation Investigative Institute. But it turned out that the Treasury Department wound up putting these records online. They just never really told anybody.
Huh.
Which they did, but I should say, so they are actually public and they are actually online. They aren't easy to go through, but somehow they just very quietly popped up on the Treasury website, you know, where you have to like dig through many, many levels to find them. There's no
There's no
notification of any kind, but they're sort of in there, which is just where I found them. But it was 400. There was a lot of pages, and they're not sort of siftable. You can't do like a search and say like search for Geithner and like pop up all the numbers. It's not like that. You actually have to go and physically count them.
Mm-hmm.
Are they
detailed to the?
I guess they didn't have money left over to hire an Excel guy to sort of make it all clear.
Now, were they detailed to the extent that you were able to see Geithner was calling Paulson or Paulson
Absolutely.
Was calling
That's
Geithner?
The way it works is it's like call from and call to, and then there's a period of time where the call comes in, and then there's also a call left message on either side as well, whether it was an incoming or outgoing call. So you get you get a sense for the time of the calls, whether there was actually when they happened, whether there was contact made, and who it was with. And if there's more than one person on the call, then there is an indication of it was a conference call, and so were on it. So, and you know, the guy is on the phone a lot. I mean,
okay. And what is the time period that you analyzed?
I looked at the month of March 2008, which was when Bear Stearns collapsed, as well as then from August 2008 through the end of the records, which is January 2009 when Paulson left. Mm-hmm. So the 7 months basically that encompassed the crisis, and I consider Bear Stearns a part of that.
Mm-hmm.
And then basically up through the end of the records.
Okay, and just to remind people at the time, Henry Paulson was Secretary of Treasury, and Timothy Geithner was the president of the New York Federal Reserve Bank. And one of the questions before we get into the details of their call activity, did it give you any indication of when you think Obama chose Geithner as his designee? Because some of that would have been critical even before the election in November?
Well, basically, Obama ultimately chose Geithner on the third week of November.
Mm-hmm.
And basically, he chose him on the November 24th, which was the day after Geithner, as the New York head of the New York Fed, and Paulson, had discussed, and Rubin actually had talked about getting a guarantee, that large $301 billion guarantee for Citigroup. So it was almost like as soon as that was done, like the next day, that was when Obama officially announced that Tim Geithner would be his Treasury Secretary.
But given the amount of money that Obama raised from Goldman Sachs, in particular Wall Street in general, do you think that there were signals out even before the election about who Obama would choose if he were elected?
I think there were signals, but more than that, before the actual election, Obama was on the phone a lot with Paulson, who was on the phone a lot with Geithner. So if you look at the patterns here, what was going on was Paulson was in much closer and more frequent contact with Geithner than he was with Ben Bernanke, who is basically who is the head of the Federal Reserve, by a fair amount. He had a total of, during that period, of 416 calls with Geithner, individual calls. This is and 268 with Bernanke. So so Geithner and Paulson were certainly a lot tighter on the old, call dial there. And then within that, Obama started having conversations with Paulson before the election.
And you point out that he had more calls with Paulson than McCain did.
Oh, yeah, more than twice as many calls with McCain. And not only did he have calls, they were more outgoing calls, twice as many outgoing calls of Paulson basically picking up the phone and talking to Obama, who wasn't the president.
Yeah.
And who wasn't on the Finance Committee. During this time period, and again far more than McCain, and they were sort of all over, they were sort of end of day calls, they were middle of day calls. I mean, there was more of a frequency there. And I actually, that was one of the most surprising things that I found out, because I don't know why I wouldn't have thought they'd be talking, but we're talking September, October, we're talking lead in, we're talking when he wasn't actually elected or anything. There was just a, not a high call volume, but a certainly decent call volume with Obama relative to McCain. So I think everybody knew who was going to win, even from, McCain's a Republican, so is Paulson, but, the sort of Wall Street connections and everything was going on in banking trumps partisanship sometimes.
And you point out that Paulson spoke to Obama slightly more than he talked to Bush, who was the president, we think.
In terms of direct calls, I mean, there was a lot of meetings with Bush, and not all of them. And that's the one thing I don't know from these records to what extent those were going on. They tended to be more sort of group meetings, but the individual one-on-one sort of the strategy stuff, there was more with Obama.
All right. And then what about Paulson's contacts with the leaders at Goldman Sachs, at Morgan Stanley, and Ken Lewis, who's on his way out of Bank of America?
Well, they were definitely his three favorites. Lloyd Blankfein, CEO of Goldman, and John Mack, CEO of Morgan Stanley, and Ken Lewis were all sort of equal on the dial there. They basically had the same amount of calls. I was a little surprised by that. I would have thought Blankfein would have had more because the two had both, run Goldman Sachs at some point, but it turned out they were the same volume for the three of those. And this was during a time primarily when Goldman Sachs and Morgan Stanley were positioning themselves to become bank holding companies, or basically sort of transform their name so that they would get more access to any public money that was available, the decision for which would ultimately have to be approved by Ben Bernanke and the board at the Fed. But the call volume was going on with Paulson and Geithner at this time considerably. And then, of course, Lewis was trying to deal with the whole Merrill Lynch situation. Geithner doesn't really deal with Lewis now.
Mm-hmm.
Or even now he doesn't, but even sort of as he became Treasury Secretary, Lewis kind of dropped off the radar there. But then Paulson and Lewis had a historical relationship as well. Paulson had effectively been a banker before he was Treasury Secretary. There was a very strong relationship between Goldman Sachs and Bank of America while Bank of America was buying a lot of other banks throughout the years.
Mm-hmm. And I'll just read this briefly. Other bankers were looped in two, Citigroup senior counselor Robert Rubin and CEO Vikram Pandit, 34 total calls with Hank Paulson. Merrill Lynch CEO John Thain, 24 calls. J.P. Morgan Chase CEO Jamie Dimon, 21. And Wells Fargo only got 3 calls. That's interesting.
And Wells Fargo didn't get They actually got the least amount of federal assistance. So actually there's a direct correlation between...
Yeah, but the shotgun wedding with Wachovia, shouldn't that have taken more than 3 phone calls?
it should have, but the interesting thing about all of that is Wachovia was very well sort of... it was overseen by another former Goldman person for a second there, Bob Steele.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of the conversations were going through that end as opposed to through Wells Fargo CEO John Stump, mm-hmm. who sort of has it now. So there's a lot of also some background maneuvering going on.
All right, and what about Robert Rubin? Because he was, he with Larry Summers was really the key duo who advised President Clinton. And then from the government, Rubin went to work for Citigroup. And it appears that he was really the power there and that Pandit was just a figurehead, at least in terms of these back-channel communications.
Yeah, it's by a really great degree. I mean, actually, the week when Citigroup got that very big guarantee, Pandit kind of got a courtesy call after, it seems. Rubin was really the one who was involved at that time and before that time. And, of course, the two had that common background. I say that in the piece. They have the very exclusive club orientation of both having been Goldman Sachs CEOs and both having been Treasury Secretaries.
Mm-hmm.
That's a very tiny little club there, so they had that. But definitely Rubin was the go-to person by about 3 times the number of direct communications than Pandit, who was running the firm.
And Nomi, you accurately conclude your piece with what's wrong with this picture, and you answer your own question, absolutely everything. And in closing, let me ask you this. Did this group of crony capitalists put first the interests of the United States and our economic stability, or did they use this crisis mentality to grab things that they had wanted from the government? For example, the way Goldman was rewritten as a bank and now qualifies for FDIC protection, I believe.
Yes.
Is that something like that was on a wish list for a long time and they were just waiting for the moment when nobody was looking and everybody was scared shitless to try to jam it through?
Yeah, I mean, definitely there have been conversations about becoming a bank holding company. And then what was ironic was at the time, and like the Wall Street Journal and other people reported this, they made it seem once approval got through for that officially on September 21st that this was somehow Goldman needed more regulation. Goldman had come to this epiphany that basically we really need more regulation. So if we are a bank holding company, we will be watched over more closely. And they actually really spun it this way in their PR, which was, and very few, I mean, certainly some people noticed that was kind of ridiculous, but the main banners in the news were very supportive of this idea that because the world was crumbling, these mighty banks were allowing themselves to be monitored. But really, that wasn't the point. The whole point was to get money.
Mm-hmm.
And they have years to, lobby against being monitored after the fact.
Yeah. The other lingering question I have, Nomi, is, take, for example, the way they forced Merrill on Bank of America and Countrywide, too. And presumably, B of A was a relatively healthy institution before those two forced mergers or acquisitions. And this gets at 2 points. One, that bankruptcy is the way to resolve insolvencies. And secondly, that they ignored the too-big-to-fail problem and created even bigger monsters and fed them toxic product.
Right, yeah.
And this just seems to be rebuilding a...
mine.
Yeah, they rebuild a sandcastle on quicksand, and
right.
We're supposed to all believe that because the stock market hit 10,000,
right.
that we're all back on track and everything's okay.
Yeah, it's so staggering. I mean, if things weren't bad, if last fall wasn't an indication that there's definitely problems in the system, coming out of the crisis with more government support backing the system, fewer banks that are bigger, more powerful, and have still many assets that no one has a clue as to how to value them or if they have any value sitting on their books, the ones that aren't sitting with the Fed in return for loans. It's amazing that it happened. It's kind of incredible, but it has, and you know, so we have the situation where Bank of America and Merrill are this very convoluted institution, or Goldman and Morgan Stanley are bank holding companies, where J.P. Morgan Chase just got bigger with a lot of federal capital behind them, and you know, and it just continues.
Yeah, and Chase got WaMu, Washington Mutual, which is big on the West Coast.
Which they had wanted for years. I mean, again, this was a shakeout that, you know, I don't know that they actually caused the crisis, but they certainly acted very, very quickly, the power banks, to take advantage of it, and they were successful.
Nomi Prins, N-O-M-I-P-R-I-N-S, and there's a website, if you spell her name correctly, nomiprins.com. Her new book is It Takes a Pillage, Behind the Bonuses, Bailouts, and Backroom Deals from Washington to Wall Street. And Nomi, they've got a book on the way to me. When I have had a chance to get it, I'll read it, and we'll arrange another time to talk so that I can get into some of the details of your book.
Perfect. That sounds great. Thank you.
Thanks for joining me today, Nomi.
Thank you.
We continue on the Peter B. Collins Show. If you're working for a living, how safe is your workplace? That's what we're going to discuss in this portion of the Peter B. Collins Show.
Sunday morning ever, and Sunday pass on by. I'll be working here forever, at least until I die. Damn if you do, damn if you don't. I'm supposed to get a raise next week, you know damn well I won't. Working for a living, work. Working for a living. Working for a living, living and a working. I'm taking what they're giving, cause I'm working for a living.
Huey Lewis, taking what they're given, working for a living, and sometimes they're giving you things that they don't tell you about or that you find out about years later. And I'm thinking of exposure to toxic conditions in the workplace. And that's what we're going to discuss on this portion of the Peter B. Collins Show today. And I want to thank Del Leonard. He has been a longtime podcast listener to this program, and he's been in touch with me over the last 6 months or so, suggesting that we discuss this issue. And Del Leonard has spent more than 23 years in the whole area of occupational health and safety as a consultant, employed by an environmental civil engineering consulting firm in Portland, Maine. And he worked for 11 years as an industrial hygiene and safety engineer at an electronics semiconductor manufacturer. Del Leonard, welcome to the program.
Peter B., it's an honor to be on your program.
Well, you're a great listener. I appreciate all the feedback that you've given me over the time that you've been podcasting this show. And I also appreciate that you've raised important issues that certainly don't get covered much in the media. And so I hope that this will be at least an introduction to our listeners of some of the issues that people in the workplace are dealing with, what level of safety and enforcement is being supported by federal and state agencies, and some of the problems that occur inside these agencies. And you were kind enough to reach out to Adam Finkel, who is a scientist and a former manager of the federal agency OSHA, the Occupational Safety and Health Administration. And he is affiliated with the University of Pennsylvania, their program on regulation and workplace health. And he is also affiliated with the University Medical, it's UMDNJ. Dr. Finkel, welcome to our program.
Thank you. Good to be here.
And the School of Public Health with the UMDNJ, that's a medical and dental school in New Jersey, is that right?
Right. It used to be part of Rutgers. It's now University of Medicine and Dentistry of New Jersey.
I see. Okay. And give us a quick sketch of what your role is in each of these institutions.
Well, I teach public health at UMDNJ, where I'm professor there, but the last year and a half or so I've been also at the law school at Penn, where I help direct the Penn Program on Regulation. That's a university-wide center that deals with the regulatory process in federal and state agencies.
Mm-hmm. And you also have an interesting career with the federal OSHA agency that didn't end probably the way you had hoped, and I want to spend a little time in a few minutes talking about that. But as we begin, Del, you were kind enough to send me some information, just very broad information, about some well-known people who were sickened, disabled, or died due to exposure to hazardous materials in their workplace. For example, Vitas Gerulaitis, the tennis player, exposed to carbon monoxide. And you have lists here that include many famous actors, Judy Garland and Burt Lahr, Back there playing Dorothy and the Cowardly Lion in The Wizard of Oz. They were exposed to asbestos in the poppy field snow scene. Many people remember that because, gee, I watched it every year as a kid. John Wayne, Susan Hayward, and Agnes Moorehead, and 46 others on the movie set of The Conqueror were exposed to radiation from nuclear weapons testing. And notably, it is alleged that Muhammad Ali's Parkinson's disease did not come from the head trauma from his boxing career, but may have actually been due to a pesticide exposure. Do you know anything more about Muhammad Ali's case?
No, I've only read what that link is I sent you, but that was fascinating that apparently Muhammad Ali had a obsession with insects or small critters and would frequently spray his at home or whatever he was at, and they suspect that it was actually caused by his exposure to that material, head trauma, repeated head trauma.
Well, very interesting, and you know, I'm here in California, where Silicon Valley is a very important driver to our economy. It's a huge source of jobs, and it's also a source of a lot of toxic exposures. The clean rooms where they make chips and some of the other facilities not only expose workers to toxic chemicals and other conditions, but also we're very concerned about the groundwater here. And Dell, you spent 11 years working in the electronics and semiconductor industry. Give us a quick sketch of some of the issues there that concern you that may not have gotten a sufficient amount of attention.
Yeah, one of the most interesting things I discovered as I went through the 11 years was that generally the semiconductor industry, at least up until I left in 2005, was extremely proactive. And for example, they would use the most recent recommended exposure limits, not the OSHA exposure limits, for substances they use. And they would use those limits as evacuation limits. In other words, you could have been exposed. If there were a limit over an 8 hours, they would still use it as a limit that you had to evacuate the work environment. So the tools and equipment were often well-engineered for the process materials, whether those are gases or liquid, which they use. But there was little attention given to the residues that were left behind. And a lot of times that these process gases or process solids we converted into another toxic form. And often it was the technicians that had to go in and at some frequency, whether it was weekly or monthly, would have to go in and clean the material out. And that's where you had a lot of unaddressed exposures that I worked to figure out what they were and how we were going to address those exposures.
And I won't ask you to name the companies that you worked for unless you want to, but were they receptive and responsive when you pointed out workplace hazards? Did they want to deal with them regardless of the cost, regardless of whether it might slow down production? Or did they pick and choose and say, well, Dell, on that one, that's too expensive. We can't shut down the line right now because that could affect our quarterly profits?
That's a good question. For the 11 years I was there, the company I worked for was actually very proactive. When I found an issue, they did invest the money to deal with it. For example, arsenic was one of the first things that they did invest a lot of money to deal with, and they weren't dealing with it very well before, but they actually developed a dedicated room with dedicated hoods, and we looked at each job task and process, and they actually did invest a lot. What was telling to me, though, was up until the time I left, for the entire company of 15,000 employees worldwide, there was only two that had certification in industrial hygiene, which was, to me, remarkable because here you have all these highly toxic and reactive materials, but you had relatively few people actually had attained a professional level to get certification in the field. And when I was laid off along with other veteran employees in 2005, they didn't replace it. The position, the person there doesn't have the certification and really doesn't have the background at all.
Mm-hmm. And Dr. Finkel, let me turn to you now. In broad terms, from your own experience, are industries concerned about the impact, first and foremost, on their workers and secondly on consumers to the extent that certain products carry a toxic load right on through to where the consumer purchases or takes possession of a product. And has government regulation in the long view been effective at making worse workplaces safer for the workers and actually reducing costs and risks for the employer?
Well, unfortunately, it's very difficult to tell, you know, to what extent workplaces have become safer, and then within that question, to what extent those improvements have been done voluntarily or through federal regulation or through the natural process of deindustrialization and changes in the economy. Unfortunately, we just don't have, we have information, but it's been kept sort of locked up within OSHA in some cases, and the agency has been very disinterested in looking at it to shine a light on its own performance. So I would certainly say, just as the air and water are cleaner now, certainly than they were 30 years ago, workplaces are generally less toxic, but to what extent they are, we don't know. To what extent outliers, companies that have been able to fly under the radar, persist, we don't know. And, of course, to what extent new chemicals that are introduced into commerce are more dangerous than ones from an earlier day, we don't really know that either. I think what you talked about earlier with the anecdotes of the famous people who have gotten occupational disease is really interesting, because it, to me, it really shows how rare it is that we have the ability to connect the dots between the exposure and the outcome. And in those rare cases where we can, it sometimes leads to action. But my concern is that the vast, vast majority of cases, scientists estimate probably on the order of 40,000 Americans die prematurely every year from exposures to hazardous materials on the job. The vast, vast majority of those are sort of lost in the background of the fact that, for example, more than 500,000 of us get cancer during our lifetime from whatever sources, and another 40,000 due to the workplace is a huge number, but not actually big enough that you can really tell for any individual that that disease was caused by workplace exposure.
Mm-hmm. Now, Dr. Finkel, from your perspective, what would you say? There's this old phrase, you know, it's a dirty job, but somebody's got to do it. And there are some jobs that are clearly very dirty, risky in terms of exposure for the workers. And coal mining is one that comes to mind. We're very aware now of the damage caused by people who worked in the asbestos industry and in construction sites where they installed asbestos, and many other places where people were exposed to it after it had already been, say, installed in a building. If you could tick off maybe, you know, the top five dirtiest work environments in America, what might those be?
You know, it's a hard question to answer, because, of course, it's not just the concentration of the material. It's the potency or the carcinogenicity of the material, the frequency of exposures. So, yeah, there are some sort of traditional jobs, for example, the substance chromium that is used in tens of thousands of workplaces around the country is, at least in one of its forms, is a known human carcinogen. So welders, electroplaters, construction sites, shipyards, jobs within those sectors may have a lot of chromium exposure, but people working alongside those people may not get nearly as dangerous a level.
Mm-hmm.
There are office jobs that, because of unusual materials that sometimes are in white-collar environments, can be risky. Healthcare is becoming not only a growing industry in terms of numbers, but and not only infectious disease, but there are obviously chemicals and drugs and radiation used in the healthcare setting. And as more and more people work in that industry, that's becoming more of a problem.
Dr. Finkel, I'd like to chime in a little bit when you talked about hexavalent chrome. It's remarkable to me that it was only in early 2007 that OSHA actually promulgated a comprehensive health standard for hexavalent chromium. And I just think of all the work environments I was in and seeing stainless steels welded and torched, and all that hexavalent chrome exposure completely uncontrolled.
Well, it it's worse than that, actually, because, and you probably being kind,
probably, yeah.
That's the substance that I believe Pliny the Elder, back in about 10 BC, wrote about. And OSHA was formed in 1970. It took them, as you say, until it was actually 2006, on the last day of a court-imposed final deadline for the agency to get around to regulating that. And the worst part of it is that, and I'm responsible for some of that delay when I worked there in the late 90s, but the worst part of it is that when the standard finally came out, it was, in my mind, probably the single most lax, almost barbarically lax, exposure limit ever set by a federal agency. It declares victory. It declares the mission accomplished in a situation where people can now legally be exposed to enough chromium by inhalation to give them an additional cancer risk of something around 4%. So that's 4 people out of 100 at the permissible level. And that's actually a higher level than a lot of industries were already voluntarily controlling down to. So here's the government saying, if you want to be a little more dirty, that's okay with us. It was really a debacle.
We should point out, too, just as a wonky industrial hygiene detail, that when you do torch or weld stainless steels, you also get oxidized nickel, which is another carcinogen.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm.
You get both carcinogens in one.
Now, let me ask each of you to respond to this. To what extent do these industries that OSHA monitors and hopefully regulates most closely, at a certain point, just say, you know, it's just a cost of doing business, and we would prefer to accept these risks and pay out insurance claims, accept a higher mortality rate among our workers, because, you know, the cost of correcting these issues may be prohibitive, may even block us from producing the substances or the end products that we make our money on. Dr. Finkel, is there a cynical view in some quarters that, hey, it's just a cost of doing business?
Yeah, unfortunately, I think that's true in some cases. Obviously, a lot of individual companies, without needing to be reined in by government, have done a very good job modernizing and improving their conditions. It's really the 5 or 10% in each industrial sector who just want to cut the corners. But yeah, you're certainly right that it's really not even a cost of doing business, because the diseases usually take decades to appear, and the worker who dies at 50 from an exposure sustained to 20 is probably not even going to come under the first employer's health plan anyway.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, the tragedy is that I think you're right that that's the mindset, that it's expensive, and therefore, if we can get away with not doing it, we can try. The terrible irony is it's not that expensive. And in many, many cases, the evaluations after the fact have shown that industry is either deliberately pessimistic or just taken in by the pessimism of oftentimes their own trade associations, and they talk about how burdensome these regulations would be, when in fact it very often spurs them to modernize, recover money, save money by wasting less product, innovate in ways that are good for the bottom line. And a lot of these rules in the toxic substance area have turned out to be far less expensive than predicted, as we've seen in the environmental area as well. We have catalytic converters on the cars, and I think everybody knows that the cost of that hardware has gone down over time,
yeah.
And it's not added to the sticker price very much.
Mm-hmm. Dell, your comment on the cost of doing business?
Yeah, that's Dr. Finkel makes some great points, and I think it's a lot of times it's a maybe a little bit more of a mixed picture, but I can, going back to the arsenic issue I talked about earlier, I didn't add up the numbers, but I can almost guarantee you that by making that process more efficient, by consolidating it, by putting in dedicated hoods, if we just did a time and time study and how much time they were spending on this process all spread out about the plant, not to mention the exposures that might be externalized with just that, they would have more than paid for it. It was much more efficient to do it the safe way, and it ended up being a much more cost-effective way.
Mm-hmm.
Because we ended up consolidating these processes. And so I wish I had looked looking back.
If I just jump in for a second.
Sure, go ahead, Doctor.
Yeah, I'm sorry. It just reminded me that one of the difficulties is I worked in the environmental health area before I came to OSHA. I was involved in, for example, if anybody remembers, the ALAR case in the late 80s.
Oh, sure. That's the apple pesticide.
Right. I did expert witnessing for 60 Minutes on that case. And when I came to OSHA, I was really blown away by the not only the extent to which the concentrations that people are exposed to are thousands, if not millions of times higher, but of course the degree of public outrage and interest in the exposures that the same people often get during their eight-hour workday as opposed to the 16 other hours that they're at home or asleep or outside, is just, there's no comparison to the amount of public mobilization about environmental health hazards. And so when you talk about the expense to companies of doing a better job, part of the problem is that consumers are partially not educated and partly at this point don't care to be educated about the extent to which their choices in the marketplace could be the necessary spur to companies to clean up. There are people making organic produce now because people demanded it. Nobody is really demanding safer products in the sense that they're safer for the people who bring them to us as opposed to safer for the people who purchase them. And the example that really sticks in my mind is from Consumer Reports magazine. Now, that's a wonderful publication, but founded many years ago by activists and union people. And once in a while, every few months or so, they will have a story about some a consumer product that is taking a toll on workers, and they have never seemed to mention that part of it. And so they had a piece 2 years ago on microwave popcorn. Now, from inside the field, we know that's a hot issue because the artificial butter flavoring that is used to produce the microwave popcorn turns out to be a very potent respiratory irritant and toxin, and somewhere in the neighborhood of 100 workers are either deceased or awaiting lung transplants from their exposure to this chemical. And yet Consumer Reports had this perfectly fine piece of writing about what you should buy, and it was all about, here's a brand that's cheaper, here's a brand that has less sodium, here's a brand that tastes better, fewer calories, whatever, and didn't mention that some of these brands, you can make the purchase safe in the knowledge that it's not contributing to worker fatalities, whereas other brands that use this flavoring probably are.
Very interesting. Now, it's...
Add one more thing to that, Peter Bick.
Go ahead, Del.
Uh-huh. Yeah, I was just thinking that I've been reading professional articles. I was aware of the popcorn issue and exposure to those workers and the lung disease, but I never saw anything of it on national sort of mainstream media until I saw one story about somebody who was obsessed about eating popcorn and would pop it for breakfast, lunch, and dinner, actually started succumbing to the same symptoms and the lung disease that those workers did. But there's never a mention on the workers' exposure, which to me, I mean, it's not even on the radar screen. Like, that would be a logical question to me. My goodness, if somebody in their house can get it, what about the people making it?
Mm-hmm. Very interesting. Now, Dr. Finkel, I find it fairly easy to demonize greedy corporations and suggest that they want to cut corners on workplace safety in order to make profits. But I want to be fair that in many cases we have workers who either don't cooperate with safety protocols, or we've seen recently there are demonstrations in West Virginia and other states by miners against environmentalists who are opposed to what they call mountaintop mining. And this is a process that just devastates the area as they extract the coal and leave this mountaintop with all the detritus that goes into creek beds and rivers and hollers, as they call them in West Virginia, down below. And the health impacts of that are very serious and pronounced and demonstrated. And yet jobs often trump safety, and we're seeing that on the faces of these angry miners who are saying, let me at this work. I don't care what it costs me or my family.
I agree with you. I think part of the problem is that I'm not going to point a finger, but I think that we have allowed forces in society to drive a wedge between the environmental movement and the labor movement. And there are beginning to be these blue-green coalitions that are trying to get past that and to make the point that these are not conflicting movements, but that they really depend on each other, and that we can, again, getting back to the idea that I believe very firmly in cost-benefit thinking, and that we ought to not do things where the costs outweigh the benefits, but getting back to the idea that a lot of the costs have been exaggerated. I think the more that we explain to people, whether they're in the on the production side or on the labor side, that it's not very often a trade-off between your job or your health or your neighbor's health or the consumer's health, that there are ways to keep the job, but to do it more safely. Now, there are some times that doesn't happen. I mean, there are very few typewriter repairmen anymore, and that's unfortunate for the typewriter repairmen who've been sort of outpaced by computers, but in the long run, we do adjust to those sort of thing. And maybe if the only skill you have is knowing how to cut the tops of mountains off, we need to come up with ways to gradually sort of get people out of that dependence on that particular mm-hmm. kind of occupation.
Well, and one place we could start is just being honest that clean coal is a lie. extracting coal and burning coal is not clean. It may be marginally cleaner than the way we used to do it without some scrubbers and mm-hmm. other techniques, but fundamentally, we're being asked to make a choice between keeping our lights on and polluting the air and warming the environment, and I think those are false choices.
Agreed. And again, part of the problem is that when I was at OSHA, obviously the national organized labor movement has been the major impetus behind a lot of the good that has come out of federal and state efforts in this regard. But it's not always the case that the big national unions always have worker health and safety at the tops of their agendas, or that mm-hmm. they're always effective in the ways that they advocate for that. And with fewer and fewer workers being unionized, OSHA really needs to get away from always thinking of things as a triangle. You have to involve the producers and the unions. The workplace is much broader now than it was 30 years ago, and of course the unions have a lot of other internal priorities for organization and membership and things that are not health and safety. We need some advocates for workers as workers, not just as unionized workers.
That's Dr. Adam Finkel, and you're listening to the Peter B. Collins Show. Del Leonard is with us as well. And Dr. Finkel, I want to focus with you for a few minutes here and ask you to first describe your early connection with OSHA. It was started by statute by Congress in 1970. When did you join the Occupational Safety and Health Administration?
I came in 1995.
95, okay. And did you come in at the management level, or did you move up through the ranks?
No, I was one of the few people recruited at the top career level. I came right in as director of rulemaking in 95. It's a fairly small agency, and most of the dozen or so top managers have come up through the ranks, but they needed a scientist risk assessor and tapped me from academia for that.
Mm-hmm. Okay. And so you had exposure, if you'll pardon the use of that word, to the politics of the Clinton administration and the George W. Bush administration. How would you compare their approach to OSHA and the level of investigation and enforcement that each administration fostered?
I have, as you say, an insider's take on this, but it's probably not the perspective that many people would expect. Certainly things got a little more difficult both for me and for the workplace as a whole after the election of 2000, but actually not nearly as much as you might expect. I'm a big believer in public service and the value of government. I went to the Kennedy School in the 80s and got a master's in government. And I'm very depressed by the rhetoric these days about government being the problem. Nevertheless, OSHA has been a problem for its whole existence, and the marginal worsening of the agency after the 2000 election was significant, but not huge. It was coming from a pretty low point to begin with.
Well, let me press you a little bit, because George W. Bush used a process that started under Reagan, and it's what I call the wrecking crew. And that is, he would appoint people to cabinet agencies whose histories, careers, and financial interests are diametrically opposed to the mission of those agencies. And we saw it at Interior. We saw it in virtually every department. In the Labor Department, and I'm a longtime union member and have belonged to my union's national board, so I'm a little biased here. But they appointed the wife of the Republican majority leader, Mitch McConnell's wife, Elaine Chao, to be the Secretary of Labor. And she spent most of her tenure there undoing the work that progressives had put in place over 30 to 50 years before. And the most notable thing was that she sent around a memo signed by the labor secretary, which gave advice to employers on how to avoid paying overtime to people by, you know, falsely claiming that they were management. So you faced the wrecking crew in the person of a guy named John Henshaw. And I'd like you to describe a little bit about his background. He came from Monsanto, right?
Right. Let me just step back for a second and say, you know, I don't think we're disagreeing. All I'm trying to say is that the wrecking crew that came to the Labor Department and that came to OSHA was sort of abetted by a career wrecking crew that had already been there.
Mm.
Certainly, having worked for Robert Reich and for Elaine Chao, there was a night and day difference between their skill level also, but you know, particularly their commitment to the mission and their interest in the mission. But I did work for somebody under Clinton administration after Reich left, who talked about the mission but was fundamentally not all that much more interested in effectively managing OSHA than John Henshaw was. And I'm just saying that in all of the parts of government where that election really made things a whole lot worse, mm-hmm. I was in one place where things got a little bit worse. But the fact that it changed from happy talk about the mission to undermine the mission actually didn't make it a whole lot less effective than it was to start with.
Okay. Now, take a little time here and explain how you were advocating inside OSHA regarding a study about inspectors. These are OSHA inspectors who had been exposed to beryllium. And this started out, I believe, during the latter years of the Clinton administration. And the studies, the reports, and the maneuvers through the bureaucracy came to a potential completion while you were still there under the Bush administration.
Right. This was, of course, beryllium is a metal that's used in a lot of high-tech industries, aircraft, computers, a lot of other places. And it has a disease named after it called chronic beryllium disease. It's been known about for at least 60 years. So there's really no question that some workers at some concentrations can get a immunological lung disease that has killed many, many workers over the decades. And, yeah, as you say, starting in the late 90s, when Clinton was still president, OSHA set about not only to update its decades-old rule on private sector workers, but part of the groundwork for that was looking inward at its own employees, the inspectors who go out and look for beryllium in the workplaces, and try to decide what to do about a fairly reliable by that point, but fairly new medical test that was available, a blood test, to tell individuals who had been what's called sensitized, which basically means that a switch has been thrown in your body and you are one very important step closer to getting the very grave lung disease. And so this was gradually, in an orderly way, making its way through the system. And when the recommendation finally was ready for a decision point in about 2002, my then boss, John Henshaw, who, as you say, was appointed by George W. and who came from decades before that with Monsanto, his decision was not to provide the medical tests to the OSHA workforce, not to inform the particular employees who we knew from the database had the highest encounters with beryllium in their careers, and just to basically not do what I thought was not only the right thing scientifically, but I mean clearly the right thing politically. The agency that protects American workers should be protecting its own workers, and not the right thing strategically. We had just seen at that time the Department of Energy, which has a reputation, or at least had a reputation, as a not particularly good public sector employer, do the right thing several years before and initiate a huge testing program for its employees, incidentally spearheaded by David Michels, who is now about to be voted on as the new head of OSHA.
Mm-hmm.
So I went to John Henshaw and said, the science is clearly pointing in this direction. The medical test costs about $150 per person. It will tell some small number of people, I thought about 1% of the inspectors, that they are much closer to a grave disease and need to get some counseling and some exposure reductions. And we'll tell 99% of them that they, for the price of a $100 test, that they have not passed that threshold and don't need to be in fear of their future health at this point.
And it's a relatively small pool of people potentially exposed, about 1,000 active inspectors and about 1,000 retirees. Is that right?
Right, not counting the people who work for state OSHA programs, but still, even if you add those in, both active and retirees, we're talking 4,000 to 5,000 people total.
Mm-hmm. So not a large group of people, not a huge cost involved in notifying and testing them, yet Henshaw, for apparent political reasons, blocked you.
Yeah, I don't know if it was political or just even though he is and was a certified industrial hygienist, just didn't really understand the gravity of the situation and the ease with which this problem could be solved. But nevertheless, the decision was to table the discussion and not move forward.
And so what did you do at that point?
I think I made one or two more runs at him by email and phone to try and get him to change his mind. And after about 6 months of getting nowhere, I got frustrated. And when a reporter for a trade newsletter asked me if there was any interesting stories that could be investigated, I brought up this issue, told him of the decision, not public, of course, not to proceed. And an article came out to that effect a month or so later. And the day the article appeared, I got a phone call. I was at that time the chief OSHA official out in the Rocky Mountain region in Denver, told to fly to D.C. for a meeting. I didn't quite know why. And then when I got there a couple days later, I was told that Henshaw wanted to see me privately beforehand. And he basically told me at that time I was doing a terrible job in Denver and needed to be essentially fired. Ultimately, the option was to come back to D.C. and be assigned to a private sector organization outside of the Labor Department to be on government salary to do basically nothing for a friend of the Labor Department.
Mm-hmm. Okay. And so do you identify with the term whistleblower?
Oh, yeah. At the time, I didn't realize that that's what I was doing, or if I did, I certainly didn't lay all the groundwork and do it in the most clever way possible. I just went ahead and did it. My name was not on the story, but it was obvious. I was really the only strong advocate for this program at that point within the agency. And I certainly identify with it in large part because not only is OSHA the worker protection agency for the country, but most people don't know it is the whistleblower protection agency for a lot of the country. A lot of the EPA and aviation and other statutes that have, and nowadays the Sarbanes-Oxley financial statute, whenever there's a question about people being retaliated against for blowing the whistle, it's OSHA people who do the initial casework to see whether they're meritorious claims. And so mm-hmm. here was the agency that's supposed to be at least impartial and probably by law interested in the plight of the whistleblower going after one of its own with particular relish at that point.
Well, Dr. Finkel, it was interesting to hear your response because, as you may know, I've talked to a number of whistleblowers, CIA, FBI, NSA, DEA, and a couple of other federal agencies, and not one of them is proud of the term. They describe themselves as dedicated employees who were trying to execute the mission that they were hired for, and when they found wrongdoing, political interference, or political favoritism and reported it according to the book. They were shocked that they became marginalized, were squeezed out, and that despite the validity of their claims and often the significant importance of them, that they could be buried and their jobs could be ended, or in the case of people with security clearances, their bosses had the ability to leverage that and say, well, we can't trust you anymore, and so we're pulling your security clearance. And so we see a pattern of that across the government. And again, the term whistleblower is something that nobody that I've encountered, you know, is proud of or says, well, that's what I started out to do.
Yeah, I think I won't speak for everybody, but yeah, as you say, most people don't see that that's what they're doing at the time. But of course, I supervised at that time some whistleblower investigators, and I kind of knew what I was getting into, but didn't think that it would happen, frankly, quite as clumsy and transparent a way as it did, which was, of course, to my personal benefit, because, as you know, very few people prevail either in court or with their agencies in settlement discussions. But they handled it so badly, and I had such good representation that I was able to get a rather hefty settlement before my case came to trial.
Mm-hmm. Well, I'm pleased to know that, and I hope it worked well for you in that respect. Now, Del Leonard, you've heard this story and the interesting information about Dr. Finkel's life at OSHA, and I'm curious, from your perspective, have you seen indications of politics trumping worker safety, either in terms of reduced enforcement and investigation, or watering down the science as a way of saying that a risk is, gosh, no longer a risk?
Yes, I have. And what's been frustrating is having, to be a consultant, to go into the field and deal with airborne exposure limits that are anywhere from 41 to 62 years old, and having recommended limits that are much more proactive and usually much lower value. So that's been a frustration. And one of the contaminants in particular is asphalt fume, and following the history of that and wondering why in the world are roofers and pavers, has been, up until maybe more recently, been any controls over those exposures. So.
Tell us a little bit about that, because you've developed some expertise and you sent me some detailed reports about asphalt fume and, in particular, the efforts to come up with coherent rules to try to protect the workers exposed to it.
Right. Well, this is a little research I did when I was working on my master's degree at the University of Massachusetts at Lowell. And I was just curious. I mean, when I drive by, and we've all driven by construction sites, and they're putting a new asphalt surface on a road, you know, it would just intuitively seem, gosh, that can't be healthy to be exposed, you know, for all day in that fume cloud. And as I researched it some, it was frustrating and fascinating at the same time to see how, you know, when OSHA was created, or the OSHA Act was passed, the Occupational Safety and Health Act was passed in late 1970 and then went into effect in April of 71, that it gave the ability of OSHA to adopt consensus standards, and they ended up adopting the 1968, what they called American Conference of Governmental Hygienists, the ACGH threshold limit values. So those became a regulatory air contaminants, but they missed the boat completely with, in my view, with asphalt fume, because if they had taken the 1971 ACGH TLVs, there would have been an air contaminant for asphalt fume. But they went back 3 years and they missed it right there. And then later on in the early 80s, in the early 70s, they reinterpreted another standard to include asphalt fume. And then about 10 years later, they changed that interpretation 180 degrees and excluded asphalt fume. And they tried to make a specific standard for asphalt fume in the late 80s with the other air contaminants, and that was undermined mostly, from what I've researched, by politically, and eventually never became standard. So we're still at today in 2009. There is no even an air contaminant limit for asphalt fumes.
Now, a lot, not certainly the majority, but a whole lot of asphalt that is deployed in this country is paid for by federal tax dollars. You see those signs on the highway, your tax dollars at work. Del, to your knowledge, have there been efforts in the Congress to try to use the transportation and highway funding that comes from the federal government to raise these standards and protect the workers who are putting down that paving surface?
That's an excellent question, and when I wrote the paper, I brought that up. Well, it seems like the government has the leverage to do that. The one positive thing that's happened, and this is a voluntary compliance in the late 90s, where makers of large asphalt pavers, 16,000 pounds and above, started implementing ventilation systems on. But as we speak now, I don't believe that those are standard equipment on all pavers, large, particularly the smaller ones. Mm-hmm. I don't know. They haven't exercised the leverage, and it seems like they certainly have it.
That is a good, if I can jump in, that's a good example of the change that did occur with the 2000 election, because in the Clinton administration, there was, for some good substantive reasons, but also some political and public relation reasons, an emphasis on what we were beginning to call partnerships. So the idea of getting companies and the government and, when appropriate, the unions together to sort of reason together, come up with a plan of action, and not do it necessarily through cumbersome rulemaking, but through more of a consensual, but, you know, with some enforcement mechanism.
Mm-hmm.
And when Bush came in 2001 and John Henshaw came to OSHA, the buzzword was changed, perhaps subtly, to alliances, and alliances became an increasingly large obsession and sink of time and effort from the agency. And as best I can tell, the difference between a partnership and alliance and an alliance is that a partnership has the potential, at least, to actually change the behavior of some manufacturer, producer who's involved in it, whereas an alliance is almost by definition a reward for past behavior, or a photo opportunity for the company and the agency to get together.
Mm-hmm.
And these alliances are one-page documents that sort of say, we, the government, think this company or this group is doing a good job, and pat them on the back and tell them to keep doing it.
Well,
so the whole concept of getting together with the regulated community and trying to improve got turned around into, let's just validate current behavior and move away.
Well, I appreciate that point, because I'm not one who feels that these issues have to be handled in a contentious manner. On the other hand, we're seeing that self-regulation on Wall Street was a real brilliant idea. And so when they say, trust me, you know, it's in the interests of the industry or a given company to police these matters themselves, well, I'm sorry. They will defer, delay for quarterly profit reports. They'll raid the pension fund. I mean, all kinds of things happen when we accept a trust me approach. And so I guess it's the old Reagan line about trust but verify.
Exactly. And I think we were making some good progress towards that in the 90s. And I'm not trying to argue against myself, but that was a watershed moment with an election, and that progress was quickly undone.
Mm-hmm. Well, gentlemen, I want to thank you for joining us today. I think this has been an interesting discussion, and I hope it opens some ears and eyes about the risks in the workplace, and that we have to be vigilant, and that government does perform a valuable function, but doesn't always come through in a conclusive way because of politics or other issues. And I hope that people will pay attention to these and think beyond the immediate risks and the known risks that they might face, and try to identify what risks might not be properly disclosed to them. Perhaps in some cases the science is still in its early stages, but I think that this kind of awareness is very important in every workplace. So I want to thank Del Leonard for joining us from Maine today, and Dr. Adam Finkel with the University of Pennsylvania and the former Rutgers School, the University of Medical and Dental New Jersey School of Public Health. Gentlemen, thanks for visiting with us here on the Peter B. Collins Show.
Thank you. I enjoyed it.
Thank you.
Thanks for listening to this edition of the Peter B. Collins Show. Your feedback is welcome. Email me, peter@peterbcollins.com. Happy trails.
Happy trails to you until we meet again. Happy trails.